First of all, thank you to Henry and Rose Brustowski for sponsoring today in memory of Rose's father, Rabbi Leo Goldman, Yehuda Aryeh Leib Ben Yosef. We also give condolences to Rose and Henry for the passing of Molly's father, Norman Frank, in Kansas City. He was a very sweet man. When I knew him, he was already a little bit, not his former self, but always, a very sweet person. You can tell he had a very sweet neshama and a loss for the Kansas City community. So thank you, Henry and Rose, for sponsoring, and we give you condolences on that loss. We should hear more simchas. And Mirtz Hashem, our learning today, should be Le'ilu Nishmas, Shaul ben Yehuda Aryeh Leib ben Yosef and Natan ben Moshe, I believe his name was. Okay, we have Vayechi, the last parsha of Sefer Bereishis. Interesting to note that Vayechi is the name of the parsha, even though it's referring to the death of Yaakov, just like Sarah. Interesting correlation there. It also recalls the death of Yosef himself at the end of the parsha, which is kind of interesting. It seems like Yosef had an earlier death than the other brothers, although the timing and chronology of when everything happened is sort of mashed up in the parsha because we're trying to sort of speed through or fast forward to the beginning of next week's parsha in Shmos, when we can already talk about Moshe Rabbeinu coming to the Jewish people there. Trivia question: who's the only person to live from this time of Yaakov getting to Mitzrayim and make it all the way to the end, to the Geula, leaving Mitzrayim? Serach bas Asher. Unclear to what extent she was the daughter of Asher and how much she was maybe just a half daughter or whatever. It gets complicated. But either way, Serach bas Asher, a very important figure in Jewish history in Mitzrayim. Maybe we can talk about her a different time if we haven't already. Have we talked about her yet? I don't think we've talked about her, but a very important figure that's in the background of the whole Geula process. She's the one that holds the key. She remembers what Yaakov says to Yosef, what Yaakov says to the brothers. I think in this week's parsha, if not, it's a reference to something Yaakov heard before. Pakod Yifkod, is that this week's parsha? I don't remember, but I think it's this week's parsha, right? Either way, Serach Bas Asher holds the key, and it's only until Moshe Rabbeinu comes along, according to Tosfos, at least, quoting from the Midrash, it's only once Moshe comes along that she's able to confirm the identity of Moshe Rabbeinu as being the true leader that's going to bring the Jewish people out. That the time had come. Apparently, back then there were false messiahs too. Whenever a people is struck with some kind of tragedy for 200 years, you can imagine there are a bunch of people that claim that they're going to get him out of it. And one person after the other came, and Serach Bas Asher told him it wasn't time, until ultimately it was the time when Moshe Rabbeinu came. With that special language, Pakod Yivkod. And only Serach Bas Asher was around to tell them. That's according to Tosfos. At least to explain how exactly she was that old. There is interesting historical debate, or at least legends, that maybe she only passed away in the 12th century, and her burial is somewhere in Iran, I think. But either way, we'll leave that up for a different time. We have really now a time to talk about Yaakov, not in the sense of most of his life, which, as he told Paro last week, Ma'at Viraim, right, that his life was very difficult and very challenging, but rather the last 17 years he lives in Egypt under the security and protection of his favorite Yeled Zikunim, none other than Yosef HaTzadik, now also known as Tzafnas Paaneach, a tongue twister of a name, so we'll just stick with Yosef. But the Parsha starts talking about, it really is not much in the Parsha, to be honest. The beginning of the Parsha talks about Yaakov dying, giving brachas to Ephraim and Menashe, right? That's the switcheroo, the hand switcheroo, and the debate between Yosef and Yaakov about who's supposed to get the rights of the firstborn, and all the sort of undertones that come with that and the history that comes with that about the favoring of a son who's not the oldest and Yaakov and Esav and Yitzhak and Yishmael. You can build a whole construct of what it means to give favoritism to the younger versus the older child. But that's not what we're going to talk about. We talked about that last year. Not on Parshas Vayechi. I don't remember what we talked about Parshas Vayechi. But
it's on there, big and small.
We talked about big and small.
You compare it to the Yerach and the Shemesh and the Rishis. The right and the left.
We talked about the... Oh, no, we didn't talk about the right and the left. We talked about... That's right. We talked about the bracha that we give at a bris. Zeakatan gadol yiyeh by Ephraim and Menashe. Right? And how it's based on the bracha that Yaakov Avinu gives to the sons. He says, while it's true, agam hu yiyeh... What is it? Agam hu yiyeh legoye begam hu yigdal. Right, that Menashe is going to be great, but Achiv Hakaton Yigdal Mimenu, and the Targum Yonasan implies that we give a similar bracha at a bris. We don't exactly give that bracha at a bris, at least the one that the Targum Yonasan had in mind, but it's a similar one. Zakatan Gadol Yiyeh. I believe someone talks about it, and the Tziv talks about it. I'm not really sure, but Yivarechecha Hashem Yishmerecha that we give on Friday night to our children is prefaced by Yisimcha Elokim Kefraim Chimenasha. So it could be a similar bracha that we give to them, the Yivarechecha versus the Yishmerecha, that's Menashe and Ephraim, or Ephraim and Menashe to be more specific. And we talked about that last year on Parshas Vayishlach. I think it was Vayishlach, when Binyamin was born. And what does it mean that that Rachel called him Ben Oni and Yaakov called him Binyamin? So the Yamin, the right-hand side, is something that Yaakov focuses on in many different ways, not just here in this parsha, but he already referenced it or focused and emphasized the right hand when it came to Binyamin. And it's interesting to note that we talked about then that Reuven and Shimon, he says, Menashe and Ephraim are like Reuven and Shimon to me. And we connected those, that Reuven is Ben-Oni, even though it's a different focus. We talked about it there. You could listen to last year's Vayechi, you could listen to last year's Vayishlach, and you'll get filled in all the details about those shirim. But today we're going to talk about something else, because we already talked about those. And I expect everyone to remember everything from what we've talked about before. So we have to talk about something else. So the Parsha tells us about Vayechi, and Yaakov's giving brachas to Ephraim and Menashe. And when I was looking through different Divrei Torah, different things that people talk about this week's Parsha, the same theme comes up over and over again. So we're going to go talk about that a little bit. And then he gives the brachos to not only Ephraim and Menashe, but to all of the children, which itself is indicative of sort of a transition from focusing on one child to focusing on multiple children, which is itself something that the brothers had to learn from. Because of Yosef, fine. And then at the end of the parsha, Yosef dies himself. And ultimately, we know how that happens after Yosef dies. Vayakam Melech Chadash, Hasher Lo Yadas Yosef. New sheriff in town next week, which unfortunately leads us down the road of Avdus Mitzrayim, a necessary but nonetheless evil part of our stay in Egypt. But let's go back to the beginning of the parsha. That's the parsha in a nutshell. It's some little tidbits for you to chew on, maybe to review as you go through it yourself. But the pasuk starts Vayechi Yaakov. Now there is an invisible significance to these words. Why do I say invisible? Invisible because it's not a word, and invisible because it doesn't exist. And that is the space between the beginning of this week's parsha and the end of last week's parsha. The end of last week's parsha, right, talked about how Yosef was going to protect all the Jewish people that were now in Mitzrayim, right? Vayeshev Yisrael, meaning Yaakov, Be'eretz Mitzrayim, Be'eretz Goshen, Ve'yeach Azuba, Vayifru Vayirbu Ma'od, and they grew and they had children, and the family started to prosper, at least to proliferate. And then the pasuk says, Vayechi Yaakov Be'eretz Mitzrayim. And Yaakov lived in the land of Egypt. That he lived in Mitzrayim for 17 years, and he was 147. I think last year at some point we talked about how that compared to Yitzchak's years, Is it 23, 33 years less, right? 180 to 147 might be, according to the Das Akenim, in retribution for how he acted with Paro in last week's Parsha, in the conversation that he had. For those of you who were there when I spoke, when I tried out for the Young Israel of Oak Park, my drasha that morning was about that topic. So I'm sure you remember the importance of nonverbal communication. Okay, fine. Enough with the reviewing, Rabbi. Okay, so why is there no space? Why is there no space in between Vayigash and Vayechi? Right? Usually, especially according to Chazal's understanding or Chazal's distinction between Parshas and Aliyahs, typically you require some space. Right? It's supposed to be, I think, 8 letters of space, 8 characters of space in between a new topic and especially a new Parsha. And yet over here, there's no space. And that's even before the word Vayechi. If you look at a Sefer Torah, so you'll see there's no space in between. Happens to be that the way that we write Sefer Torah nowadays, it's at least on a new line. But even if it would be on a new line, you would require some spacing into the line. So it doesn't really matter either way, because there's no space to distinguish the Parsha from the next. So the question is why? Why is there no space? And that's what Rashi, the first Rashi in the Parsha, is asking. So verse number 2, for those of you with the sheets, says Rashi on Pasuk Pasuk Chaf Ches. This Aleph is a misleading Aleph, whatever. Vayechi Yaakov, Lama Parsha Zuz Stuma. Why is it Satum? Satum means closed, right? It's closed off. Stam could mean like simple or a default. Here it means Satum, means to be closed off. I'm trying to think of another example where we have that word. Either way, I can't think of one now. You just have to trust me. So why is it closed? Lafisha cave on Shiniftar Yaakov Avinu Nistimu Einehem V'Libam Shel Yisrael Mitzaras Hashibud. Why is it closed? Because when Yaakov Avinu passed away, his eyes were closed, but the eyes and the heart of the Jewish people were closed. Mitzaras Hashibud, from the difficulty of the working, the bondage, right? Shehischil Shabdam, because that's when the Mitrim swooped in. It's interesting because it implies that they swooped in even while Yosef was still alive. Yosef lives for another few decades after this. And nonetheless, the Shibud already started. This is actually something which is in tomorrow's daf. This is my handy dandy daf Yomi Gemara here. Tomorrow's daf talks about the word Avodas Parech, which we'll talk about in next week's Parsha, right? Which we'll read in next week's Parsha. I don't know if we'll talk about it. But the word Perach is typically understood to be back-breaking labor, like Parech is to break. So Perach, the Gemara elsewhere says, this Gemara doesn't say this explicitly, but it talks about, tomorrow's daf talks about Maror. I don't know if people know that we're in the middle of Maseches Pesachim, right? The tractate that talks all about Pesach. And Daf Lamed Tes, it talks about how Maror is used because it might taste okay at the beginning, but the aftertaste is very bitter. And the Gemara says that's because that's how it happened in Egypt. It started very nice. It said, oh, you just work for us. You'll be like an indentured servant, and we'll pay you for your work, and it'll be like work study. You know, you'll get what you need. You'll do a little work for us. And in the end of the day, we know how it happens, that ultimately it becomes more overwhelming and more difficult than that. But the word perach, the Gemara says, even though different letters. Okay, good. Very good, Randy. We talked about Vayistimun Plishtim, when the wells were dug up and then reclosed by Avimelech's servants. So it says Vayistimun, that they closed up the wells. Although over there it doesn't say with a sin or a samech. Either way, it's the same word. It doesn't matter. But here, perach, avodas parach, is understood to be, at least on a deeper level, to be peh and rach. I think in the pasuk next week, I'm not 100% sure actually. So perach could be, it's a subject, it's a conjugation of two words. Peh means mouth and rach means soft. Meaning at the beginning, they spoke very nicely. They spoke very kindly. They were very sensitive. I know you don't have a lot of money. I know you don't have a lot of food. Maybe we can help you out. You can do a little work for us on the side and we'll give you money. We'll give you food in exchange. It started that way. Avodas perach. That they started talking, you know, very sensitively, and ultimately, it didn't turn out to be so nice in the end of the day. The Marsha points out, what did the Marsha say? The Marsha says, I think quoting from the Medrash on tomorrow's daf, that that how did they start? That Paro would wear bricks on his shoulders, apparently. And they say, what, are you better than Paro? Are you more sensitive than Paro? If Paro can carry a brick, you can carry a brick. And obviously they added another brick, and another brick, and another brick, until ultimately Jewish people had to work more and more. Okay, so Rashi says that's what the first closing means. The closing is a reference to the closing of the Jewish people's hearts, a closing of the Jewish people's eyes. In other words, a closing of their hope. They had no hope left. They were destined for it. They weren't, they didn't feel like they had any hope left. Alternatively, Davar Acher, and this is the one that most people quote because it's more, I guess, intriguing in terms of what it means. Bikesh Legalos HaKetz Levanav. Yaakov Avinu wanted to tell his children about the end of the world. Vinistam Imenu. And it was closed off from him, right? Yaakov Avinu was, you know, had Ruach HaKodesh to some extent, and he had this vision of when the world is going to come to, you know, when you go through all the processes, when it's going to all finish. And then the second that he wanted to talk about it, he wanted to tell it over to the brothers, to the sons. So then Hashem closed it off. He couldn't see it anymore. This is a long Jewish history of people trying to predict when the world's going to end and when the Mashiach's going to come. And a famous letter from the Rambam in Igeres Teiman, where he talks to the people about, he talks to the people in Spain, I think, I forgot where, but they were being, you know, a lot of Jews were being, you know, persuaded by Muhammad and you know, all the Muslim influences in their area. And there are people that were predicting the end of Mashiach coming, and it lines up with Muhammad, things like that. And I don't know if it lines up, how that wouldn't make sense chronologically, but it's something they were telling them was seeming to come to fruition. And the Rambam says, you're not allowed to predict it. You're not allowed to say the time. We don't know the year. Anyone who does so, you know, is not telling you the truth, and they're just, they're selling you a false, you know, complex. And then the very next chapter, the Rambam gives a date. It's one of the most bizarre things I've ever learned. And people don't know how to explain it. The Rambam says in one paragraph, he says, don't say it. And then, you know, a few paragraphs later, he gives a time. And don't worry, it's passed. So unclear exactly why the Rambam did that. But you can look into the Geras Teiman to figure that out. So Yaakov Avinu wanted to do the same thing. Yaakov Avinu wanted to give away the end of the world. And then it was Nistam Imenu. That's why the Parsha starts off with a closing, without a break, because it was closed from him, right? It wasn't revealed to him anymore. He could no longer see it. This makes it even more interesting to give more credence to the first answer that Rashi tells us is because of the Shibud in Mitzrayim, that already at the end of Yaakov's life, it started to get bad for the Jewish people. That makes it all the more interesting to see how the Netziv and the Chizkuni talk about this word, Vayechi Yaakov. If you look at the beginning of the parsha, if you look at the first source again, Vayechi Yaakov, the Eretz Mitzrayim, Shva Esrei Shana. He lived in Egypt for 17 years. So when did Yaakov get to Mitzrayim? How old was Yaakov when he got to Mitzrayim? Just simple math. He was in Mitzrayim for 17 years, and he lived until 147. So the Torah makes it easy for us, right? You don't have to even carry the one at all. It's just 130. The only problem with that math is that we could have done it ourselves. The end of last week's Parsha said he was 130 when he went to Mitzrayim, right? In the whole list of the whole genealogy of all the children that go to Mitzrayim at the end of Parsha of Vayigash, it says he's 130. So why do I need the Torah to tell me that he lived 17 years in Egypt? I would have known that. Just tell me he died at 147. So then Netziv asks, Kol zeh miyutar. All of this is extraneous. We don't need to know it. Sharei ksiv, ahi me'akov sheva shanim me'abarim shana. Uchvar ksiv, shahaya bevol Mitzrayim me'u shloshim shana. We already know he was 130 when he got there. Just tell us he died at 147. We would know that he lived for 17 years. Why do we need to know that? Ella says the Netziv, Haperish vayechi Yaakov, shahaya chai chayim tovim. Umetukanim, mashlo hurgal bezeb eretz Yisrael. Wow, says the Netziv, a Hasidish vart. Not exactly Hasidish, I don't know that Tziv thought of Hasidism, but he would be in line in that time where maybe it wouldn't be the nicest thing to be a supporter of, although I'll leave that to the historians to figure out. Says the Netziv, Vayechi Yaakov. It's not telling us how much he lived. It's telling us that he lived. That as opposed to Eretz Yisrael, where his life was always one kvetch after another. Right? When it was Esav, and then Lavan, and then Rachel dying, you know, although Lavan, whatever, you can be mefakfik in that. But his whole life, Ad Kan, hasn't been very nice. Hasn't been very good. Yosef, you know, going away, presumably dying. So all of that has been difficult for him. But when he got to Mitzrayim, when he got to Egypt, Vayechi Yaakov, he lived a good and satisfying 17 years in Egypt, not in Israel. Fascinating, especially given the contrast to how Rashi understands it, that when it comes to the beginning of the parsha, what it means is that Yaakov died or was dying, and that was already beginning the difficulties of the Shibud. Now, maybe, as I said before, it wasn't so difficult at that time because Perach, they started sweetly, they started sensitively, whatever. But it's interesting to note that the Nesiv says Yaakov Avinu was living it up. He was loving it. You imagine a good Zaidi surrounded by his children, protected by his own son, and just watched at the end of the Parsha. Vayifru vayirbu ma'od. He just watched his family flourish. He just watched all the wonderful Enoklach, and the great-grandchildren and the great-great-grandchildren that are being born around, imagine, 147 years old. He's got 12 kids, at least. All the grandchildren that were around him, he was living it up. That's what it means, Vayechi Yaakov. He was really living. The Chizkuni says similarly in source number 4, about Kol Shar Shnosa V'chayav Lo Hayu Chayim. He wasn't really living. Shekol Yamav Hayasharoi B'tzar. Because all of his life he was living with difficulty. Umishebal Mitzrayim, and when he comes to Egypt, Nacha Rucho V'chaya B'nachas, he was at peace, and he was able to live with a certain serenity. B'nachas. And then it says the Chizkuni Be'aretz Mitzrayim to go further. Mikra Zeh Nichtav L'Shvacho Shel Yosef. This is coming to teach us that in Eretz Mitzrayim for 17 years, Yosef took care of his father. Why is that important? What does the number 17 have to do with Yosef in Mitzrayim? Because V'eskol B'nei Beso Yud Zayin Shana Kamo Sheparnes Aviv. Just like Yaakov took care of him for the first 17 years of his life, Yosef took care of his father for the last 17 of his life. Very interesting, says the Chizkuni. He was paying back Yaakov Avinu. It was, he had to be there for 17 years so that Yosef could pay him back. Shari ben Yudzayin Shana Hayak Shenimchar. Yosef was 17 years old. We know he was a na'ar, right? He played with his hair, whatever. He was 17 years old when they last met, and therefore Yosef had to pay back. Just an interesting little tidbit there, why 17 is so important. But nonetheless, we find that Yaakov Avinu enjoyed the last 17 years as opposed to the first 130. The last 17 were geschmack. The last 17 in Egypt of all places. So how could that be? How could that be that Yaakov Avinu enjoyed Egypt more than Eretz Yisrael? How could that be? You know, we're Zionists. The young Israel, we push the importance of Eretz Yisrael. We know that sometimes moving to Eretz Yisrael is difficult. But that Egypt is better than Eretz Yisrael, how could it be? How could that be that Egypt is better than Eretz Yisrael? So let's go through a little bit of the history there. If you look at source number 5, you'll find an interesting little nuance that I wanted to point out, that the Rav Moshe Feinstein points out. What do you want, mister? You're showing everybody that you need a haircut? Yeah, we're getting one hopefully this week. All the kids are on vacation, as you can imagine, from Farber. And this little Justin Bieber needs a haircut. So the pasuk says, source number 5, Mem Ches Dalet Hey, Vayomer Eli Hinani Mafrechav Ir Bisicha. Behold, you've become great. Unesaticha L'Kalamim. You've become a nation. V'nasatias Haaretz Hazos L'Aracha Acharacha Hazos L'Olam. This is actually referring to Hashem talking to Yaakov Avinu earlier. V'yata, and now, Shnei V'nachas. This is Yaakov now talking, no longer quoting Hashem. V'yata, with an ayin, means now. Shnei V'nachas. Your two sons, Hanoladim L'Chav Eretz Mitzrayim, that were born to you in Egypt, Ad Bo'i Elecha, before I got here. Mitzrayim, in Mitzrayim, they were born to you. Li Haim, they belong to me. Ephraim and Menashe, Keruvim and Shimon Yehili, as we said before, Ephraim and Menashe, I'm seeing them as Reuven and Shimon. Interesting to note that already here, before the hand switcheroo, he's verbally switching them already. Ephraim and then Menashe, not Menashe and Ephraim, which is already sort of foreboding what's going to happen in a second. But, Ash, you got it? Can you open it? Good. Ephraim and Menashe, Keruvim and Shimon Yehili. So interesting to note, what does it mean that Ephraim and Menashe are going to be mine, right? Like any good grandparent, they want to gobble them up. They want them for themselves. The grandparents oftentimes, I'm sure people here know, would love to just be with their grandchildren all the time. But they don't always know what it means to be with them at nighttime. That's why the grandparents love them so much. But either way. So what does it mean that the children of Yosef are going to be for Yaakov, just like Reuben and Shimon, asks, I mixed up the source. Let's go to source number 7. Says Rav Moshe Feinstein, what does it mean? V'yatash ne'venachan olim l'cha be'eret Mitzrayim ad bo'i l'cha. Tamu'a lashon hanoladim be'eret Mitzrayim ad bo'i Mitzrayim alihem. Says the Rav Moshe, v'chi eze tamhu. Because he came to them in Mitzrayim, because they were born in Egypt, that's why they're going to be mine, right? It sounds in the pasuk a little strange, right? These children who were born in Egypt, they're going to be mine. Because they were born in Egypt, they're going to be yours. If anything, you would say that they're going to be yours if they lived in Eretz Yisrael. What's so great again? What's so great about Egypt? We see again the same theme happening. So he says says Rav Moshe, Hanol Machar Bo Shelechora Hu Ipchapa. Presumably that's opposite. Vitzarach Lomar. I see the Vav Tzadi Lamed in the middle there, in the first column in source number 7. Vitzarach Lomar Shehu Chiddush Gadol. Big Chiddush from Yaakov Avinu. Beinyan Ad Kama Hu Chiyuv Chinuch V'Halimud Be'echus. How important it is to raise your children, to educate your children with a good quality. Why? It's not good enough to see that they're learning and they're upstanding Jews when they're in your house. When they're learning inside of the study hall. While they're living in your house, of course they're gonna play by your rules. Of course they're gonna learn when you teach them. They're under your control. You have to teach your children and your students so much. That a person's education is tested and really shows it's expressing itself only after they leave that place. When they're able to hold on to that Torah, they're able to hold on to that education and that character even after they leave. Even if they're living in a place of Ovdei Avodah Zarah, even if they're living in a non-ideal environment, which is not full of Torah values, while Yosef was still with Yaakov, he was constantly being imbibed with Yaakov's education. Right? They were face to face. Yosef also was not only affected by the surrounding Egyptian culture, but he even taught it to his children. Why are they only now do I know that Ephraim and Menashe belong to me? Because now I truly know that my education worked. That everything I taught you and I taught the other kids, now I know it worked. Now I know that it's real. It was his education. It was only Yaakov that taught Yosef anything about Judaism. You think Yosef got a Rebbe in Egypt? Of course, you think Paro taught Yosef about Judaism? The only way Yaakov and Menashe and Ephraim know about Yiddishkeit is because they got it from those 17 years in Yaakov's house. It was all because of Yaakov, and he's trying to remind him of that now, because it might not be so clear, given the fact that he's never met them until a few years ago. I remember someone once told me from Rav Bina. People have a lot of opinions about Rav Bina and the Tivarieh. We're not going to go into that, but he's done some wonderful things. And apparently they say that Rav Bina tells the boys that Shana Bet does not start until you get off the plane. And it's not the plane into Israel. It's a plane back to America. Because after you go back to America, the question is, what does Shana Bet teach you? What did your yeshiva experience do in terms of what you would do with it afterwards? It's no great feat to be learning in a base medrash where all your friends and the entire environment is to learn and to continue growing. The question is, when you get out of yeshiva, when you leave, when you go back to America, and you go back to your old, you know, stomping grounds, and you're enticed by your old desires, you're enticed by your old environment, what are you going to do then? Are you still going to keep up with your learning? Are you still going to keep up with your growing and developing as a Ben Torah, even outside the coastal Beis HaMedrash, as Rav Moshe is saying? Why is it that Yaakov Avinu feels so strongly about Menashe and Ephraim, specifically because they're in Egypt? It's because that's where he really understood the value of his education, the value of the Torah that he gave them, lived on beyond just his own home, just his own living in Eretz Yisrael. This is something that also seems to be indicated, at least according to Rav Hirsch, in the bracha that Yaakov gives to Yosef, which is towards Menashe and Ephraim. It's unclear in the Pesukim. You really have to look at the Pesukim very well. It's a difficult thing to parse. When you look at the song we all love, Hamalach Hago Elosi. I don't know how many versions you know. I probably know 5 or 6 different tunes for Hamalach Hago Elosi. Because it's clear, it's one of those lines that's just so poetic. And there's so much emotion, there's so much intimacy that's put into it. When Yaakov Avinu says to Yosef that the angel that has guarded me, or Hashem that has guarded me, through all my difficulties, should guard Menashe and Ephraim in the same way. And he says, V'yidigu larov bekarav haaretz. What is a yidigu? That's a weird word, yidigu. Hold on. People still with me here? Sorry. I don't know if you can hear me, but my computer is jumping around a little bit. Hold on. Oh no. Can you hear me? Sorry, give me a second. Hold on. Hold on, everybody. People, okay. People still here?
Here.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. I don't know what happened, but I'm glad I caught you before the whole thing shut off.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Always fun times on Zoom. Let's see. How many people did we lose? At least it looks like everyone's still here. Okay. Thanks for sticking with me.
I think we're getting an echo because you're still logged in on your other one.
You're
showing up in 2 squares, Rabbi.
Am I? Because I shut the other computer off.
Your audio I see it.
Hold on. Okay. Better?
That's good.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Yep. I just knocked myself off of the call. Sometimes you got to cut ties with those people that are making disruptions. Okay. V'yidgu larov. The Rehersh points out the word v'yidgu. V'yidgu is a very strange word, at least the way that it's used. Yidgu, dalad gimel, even though it sounds like a verb in this case, usually refers to fish. So what does it mean, v'yidgu larov? They should be like fish, says Rashi. I think we talked about this once. Maybe last year we talked about this, I don't remember. This is source number 6, going backwards. Kadagim halalu, like these fish. I don't know what these halalu means, but these fish, sheparim veravim, that they become multiples, right? They procreate. Ve'ein ayin hara shalates bahem. Not only do they procreate, not only do they become many, but they also make sure they don't have any, or not make sure, but they don't have any ayin hara. The people that when they look at them, they're not jealous, they don't curse them, they're not affected by the ayin hara. Unclear exactly what that means. We've talked about it before. If you remember, the Gemara in Baba Metzia talks about how Rabbi Yochanan would sit by the bathhouse and say to the women that your children should be as beautiful as I am. And the rabbis say, wait a second, Rabbi Yochanan, isn't that a little haughty? Isn't that a little, a little gaivadik? Rabbi Yochanan, you're an Amora, how could you say such a thing? So the Gemara says, no. Or Rabbi Yochanan says back, no, I don't have to worry because I'm from Yosef. And the Psukim tell us that, as Yaakov says, if you eat gularov, you'll be like fish. I don't have to worry about any ayin hara from saying such a thing because the ayin hara doesn't affect me because I'm from Yosef. The Gemara says, well, is he really that beautiful? Look at this list of all these rabbis. It says these are the most beautiful rabbis and he's not on the list. I don't know why they had such a list, but there is such a list. The Gemara in Baba Metzia says in Daf Pei Dalid. So the Gemara says, Rabbi Yochanan, you're not on the list. You didn't make the cut. You think you're so beautiful. Rabbi Yochanan says, no. That list is referring to beautiful rabbis with beards. I'm a beautiful rabbi without a beard. I'm not kidding. That's a real Gemara. At least according to Rashi, that's what it means. That Rabbi Yochanan was a beautiful rabbi without a beard. First modern Orthodox rabbi in history. I'm kidding. But either way. So says Rav Hirsch, what does it mean, v'yidgu larov, that you should be like a fish? Beautiful message from Rav Hirsch. There's so many beautiful messages from this one word, v'yidgu. What does it mean to be like a fish, right? What are the positive qualities of a fish, and how do those apply to Bnei Yisrael? One of them that I love, I think the Medrash says it even, that just like fish, they live in water, but when it rains, the fish go up to the surface of the water to get the new droplet. Right, to get that new, but you live in water. What do you need more water for? So the Chiddush being that even though Klal Yisrael learns and learns and learns, they're always looking for that new drop, that new piece of learning, that new idea. I love that. Either way, says Rav Hirsch, what does it mean? V'yidgu larov b'tchumam hanivdal. They're going to stay in their own section. What does that mean? B'ma'amakim. By the way, I only found the Hebrew text of this. Sorry if I don't have the English one. Actually, do I have the English one? Not here. Maybe I'll go get it if the Hebrew's not coming across clearly. B'ma'amakim, she'ayin adam eina sholetes bahem. Other people might not see them. Chayim hadagim es chayim hashketim. But the fish, even if they're not seen by the human eye, nowadays we can find more and more fish. It seems like every month they're coming up with a new species of fish because they come up with new technology. They can go deeper and deeper into the water. Right, the fish live in their own planet. It's beautiful. I don't know if you've ever seen these underwater glow-in-the-dark type things where you can see these fish. They're unbelievable. Some of these fish at the bottom of the ocean floor, they're really they're breathtaking to see the footage of them. But either way, these fish, at least until modern history, could not be seen by the human eye. And similarly, Bnei Adam ha'omdim al sfas ha'mayim enam mudaim. These people that live even at the border of the water, they're still not. They still don't know about these fish. Ve'ein lehem musag klal me'achayim chasrei hadaga. They don't know anything about chasrei hadaga. They don't know anything about how these fish live with a life of such satisfaction and sustenance, without a worry. Hanimratzim u'malay hachius. They're full of life. Hamiskayim hamitkayimim. Lamata b'shefarav, they're living with an abundance midor lador, from generation to generation. These fish just keep proliferating, and the people on earth had no clue. Kach, so too should it be. Gam yinahalu b'nei mishpachas Yaakov eschayem ha'atzmayim. Hashketim, so too Yaakov is giving a bracha to his children to say that the rest of history for the Jewish people should also, we should live in calm and peace. Hamesupakim, but satisfied and sustained. Heim yichyu bekarav haaretz, they should live inside of the land. Betchumam hanivdal, in an ability to be in their own little section. She'en la'olam shemisvivam afsharus knisa elav, that the other people of the world are not going to affect their way of life. V'she'en lo musag al ha-misrachish b'socho, and we don't need to prove ourselves to everybody else. We can just live as Jewish people in our own way, and we're satisfied to be quiet, to be humble, and to be in our own little world. Heim yechiu t'kidagim b'mayim b'kerav ha-enoshot al haaretz. They should be like fish in the water, even though there are people living around on the land all over the place. Now, this can be taken more literally and more figuratively, depending which way you want to stretch it. It's in some ways, you know, it would be a piece to sort of delve into Rav Hirsch's ideology and mixing into the world and being just, you know, separate from the world. And it's some of the historians have debated since Rav Hirsch was alive, to what extent does he really believe that we should be engaged in the world? To what extent does he believe we should be separate from the world? A lot of things that happened in his life are up for debate. You can look back at you can listen back at our Legends and Lessons class from last year, from Rav Hirsch's life, to understand a little bit more of that controversy. So this piece speaks right to it, but I just want to take a sort of the simplistic piece out of it, which is that the Jewish people, despite being in other places, despite being in other countries, despite not being in their own homeland in Eretz Yisrael, will sometimes have to deal with the outside world. And because of that fact, because they'll have to deal with the outside world, it could sometimes become difficult to maintain their own peaceful life of Judaism and Yiddishkeit. So Yaakov is giving them a bracha. They should be v'yidgu larov, according to Rav Hirsch. What does it mean to be like a fish? To not be affected by the outside world. To still be able to cut out, to shut out the rest of the world and maintain your own sense of Jewish ideology. That's what Yaakov Levine was trying to say. And similarly, if you look at, again, a similar idea is also found later on in the brachos of Yisachar and Zvulun. The Pasuk tells us, Zvulun l'chof yamim yishkon, Zvulun is going to live at the shores of the water. He's going to be the one that, at least colloquially, conventional wisdom says, Zvulun's the one that's going to be the merchant. He's going to go around. He's going to sell. He's going to be the one to really to bring in the finances, and he's going to support Yisachar, who's learning Torah. Whether exactly that's true or not is unclear. I spoke at length with David Barth about this recently. I think maybe it might have been in connection with the bracha of Zvulun and Yisachar from the Parsha and Zosa bracha. Not for now, but it's unclear whether Yisachar really didn't have any commerce or whether it was just that Zvulun had the main obligation or responsibility towards the commerce aspect. But either way, so it says that the Yisachar, on the other hand, Yisachar chamor garem. What does it mean, chamor garem? Says Rashi, chamor baal atzamos, a donkey of good bones, meaning sovel ol haTorah. He's going to carry the burden of Torah. Those broad shoulders are going to carry that load of like a donkey carries in order to really be the carrier, the transmitter of Torah. So Kli Yakar says, Kachamor zeh, shehu umasa'o, kshurim yachad lo yuzpardu, like a camel, like a donkey. When the donkey's carrying something, that load of the donkey is strapped to its back. Kshurim yachad, they're connected together. Lo yuzpardu, they're not going to separate. Kach kinyan haTorah, so too with the acquisition of Torah. Davak v'eno nifrad v'menu. So too, just like that donkey and the pack on its back, that the person who's full of Torah, the person who learns Torah, it should stay with them. It's not going to be separated from them. Meaning, v'lo kmo kinyano shel zavulin. as opposed to, in contrast to Zevulun. What does that mean, that Zevulun's not going to be like that? Shemitzah, Shehu, Beiso, Kinyanon, Nifradim, where Zevulun lives, where he does his sales, where he does his commerce, and where he keeps his inventory, are different places. You've got the place where he lives, you have the place where he keeps, you know, his warehouse, and then you have the places, all the places he goes on ships, and he goes to different port cities to sell his wares everywhere. So he's always dissociated from his living. He's separated from all the things that he does. Nifradim al kain hu baal tenua tamid. He's always moving around. Ola beso, ola kinyano, ki al harov hu heim chutz mimenu. All these things are separate from him. Aval Yisachar. When it comes to Yisachar and his learning of Torah, tamid masa'o masa dvar Hashem. What is his carrying? What is his burden? Is the Dvar Hashem. It's the words of Torah. Buhu Rovetz Ben HaMishpasayim, Hainu Ben Shnei Gvulim. He's always able to be in both of these worlds, in both of these borders, in the border of Torah and the border of his house. They're in the same place. Kichol Hatzlachas Shalaguf Yisovevehu. Everything that the body does, it's going to surround him. Orech Yamin Bimina B'smola Osher V'Kavod. Everything that he has is going to be to his right, to his left. We talked about that Pasuk in Mishlei a long time ago already. He's always going to be between those two things. Doesn't matter where he goes. Wherever he walks, however he grows, he's always going to have the Torah with him. Doesn't matter while with Torah, it doesn't matter where you go. When it comes to selling things, that's not going to happen. Sometimes you have to go to this country, sometimes you go to that city, and you're going to be separated from where you want to be, from your house, from your values, from your merchandise. Sometimes he's going to go to a dangerous place. He's going to be stuck there for a long time. Sometimes he'll have to separate from his merchandise, from his wealth, because he's not going to ultimately be able to have his wealth with him in the end of days. And therefore, he's not able to connect to always be in both borders. But someone who's learning Torah, and he's willing to carry that burden of Torah, he's always going to be on that border between both situations in his life, wherever he is, and with the Torah that he has, because that always goes with you. In a similar sense, in three different examples now, we understand that Yaakov Avinu was giving over a bracha to Menashe, to Ephraim, to Yosef, to Zevulun and Yisachar, that at least to Yisachar, that the Torah that you have should always stay with you. And especially and specifically, he can appreciate this lesson once the Jewish people have gotten to Mitzrayim. You can imagine Yaakov Avinu was told by Hashem, your children are going to be in a land that's not theirs. Pe'eretz lo lahem, va'avadum v'inu osam. And Yaakov knew this message that was told over to Avram Avinu at the Bris Bein Masarim, and Yaakov Avinu was dreading the time. He's dreading the time where he's going to have to escort his family into Egypt. All of a sudden the time comes, and he's realizing that Yosef has led the way. Yosef not only is protecting them and showing them, modeling for them how to live in terms of the physical sustenance, but he's also modeling for them how to be profitable spiritually, how to live and to maintain your identity even in a foreign place like Mitzrayim. And therefore, he gives over the brachas to his children, to Menashe and Ephraim, afterwards to Yisachar, to say basically that no matter where you go, you should always be connected to the Torah. You should always feel comfortable. No matter what surrounding you're in, as Rav Hirsch says, you should be able to section off yourself, to dissociate yourself, even in foreign cultures, to feel comfortable living with the Torah. No matter where we go, no matter where we find ourselves, we should always be comfortable with the Yiddishkeit we have. That's the lasting message that Yaakov Avinu is trying to give over to his children. So if we come full circle now to the beginning of the Shir, what does it mean? And the Tziv says, and the Chizkuni say, Kol Shar Shnosa V'chayev Lo Hayu Chayim Shekol Yamav HaYishar B'tzar. When it comes to before Egypt, his whole life was difficulty. But when he comes to Mitzrayim, Nach Harucho V'chay Ben Achas, says in the Tziv, Chay Chayim Tovim Mimutukanim. He has a beautiful life, a geshmak life in Mitzrayim in Egypt, because now he realizes he no longer has to worry. His whole life he's been chasing down this concern, what's going to be, I have all these struggles, I'm dealing with Esav, I'm dealing with Lavan, I'm dealing with Yosef. what's going to be when my children get to Eretz Lo Lahem for 400 years? They're going to be in a place where they don't have the same kind of home base that I'm providing for them. They're not going to have a Yitzchak who raised them. They're not going to have an Avram who raised them. How are they going to stick to Yiddishkeit? All of a sudden, these last 17 years, he notices, he realizes, and he learns that it can be done. No matter where we are, no matter how we find ourselves, whether it's in the Kosle Beis Hamedrash, whether we're in the walls of the shul physically, or whether we have to resort to Zoom, whether we have to resort to our own homes, to our own basements, we can always take the Torah with us like Yisachar to make sure that no matter where we go, no matter what environment we find ourselves in Galus, which Yaakov Avinu thought was going to be longer in Mitzrayim, but now for us is even longer outside of Eretz Yisrael for 2,000 years. We still have this message of Yaakov Avinu. We still have these words to learn from that we give to our children on Friday night. Yisimcha Elohim ke'Ephraim v'Menashe. You too should continue living like Ephraim and Menashe in this way of Torah, in this way of Torah and Mitzvos, even in Mitzrayim. That's the lasting message of Yaakov Avinu. And finally, he can rest. He can feel comfortable knowing that it's possible, that finally he understands the last 17 years of his life, it's possible to live a life of Yiddishkeit even outside of Eretz Yisrael. And he gives this lasting bracha to the rest of his children after Ephraim and Menashe too. We want to thank you to Henry and Rose Rostowski for sponsoring today in memory of her father, Rabbi Leo Goldman, Yehuda Ari Leib, and Yosef. Also, Le'ilui Nishmas, the recent passing of Norman Frank in Kansas City. Hopefully through our learning, their neshamos will have aliyahs, and Meretz Hashem will hear simchas and join simchas together in the near future. Thanks for joining. Sorry for the little technological...
Philosophical question.
Yeah, Chernuk. Shoot.
The spelling of Yisachar.
Yeah, it's a tough one.
What's with that second sin there?